The following program is a rebroadcast of the third in the series of book club discussions hosted by Judy Getty. The focus on this one, Pandora's Lunchbox. Enjoy.
And my guests today are Winona Benson, the nutritional educator from the Cooperative Extension Service, and Lisa Boyles, nutritionist in training. Winona, will you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah. So I work for the UAF Cooperative Extension Service as a nutrition educator, and under the heading of CES, we have the company or the program called the Family Nutrition Program, and we're in conjunction with SNAP Ed and FNEP, and what we do is we help families and individuals learn how to plan, shop for, and prepare tasty and healthy meals within a limited budget. So anyone who qualifies for any form of public assistance is eligible to be a part of our family nutrition program.
So you will be offering a lot in conjunction with this idea that eating healthy or eating organic takes a lot of money.
It does, but it's a matter of priorities a lot of times.
So how to do that within a budget even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my other guest is Lisa. Welcome, Lisa.
Hello.
And where are you at in your preparation to be a nutritionist?
I've got about a year left, hopefully, and but getting closer.
And you want to work in what particular area?
I would like to start out working with the farmers market in some way, representing, because I've got some sales skills. Try to do that, and I really believe in it, and it's fun and community effort. And then eventually settle in on older women's nutrition health needs.
Well, I'm so happy to have both of you with me, so welcome. Let's start talking about what Werner has to say. And I wanted to start by saying that I was glad she was a journalist because, you know, when you pick up a food book, you sometimes wonder, is this going to be too detailed or too sciencey? And I thought she really wrote it for most people to be able to understand. So did you get that feeling, too, as you read the book?
Yeah, I agree with you, Judy. I liked it because, number one, she wasn't necessarily coming from the food industry, so she wasn't biased in her writing. Did a lot of research and just gave us some facts, which I felt was very informative and interesting. It was a great read.
Lisa, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I think she, through the more scientific processes, was able to kind of get it to more layman's terms. I mean, it was confusing, don't get me wrong, in some of that, but she summarized well, so you kind of got the gist of what was going on. And, yeah.
So she starts out right kind of what I always think of, and what she's talking about is that she keeps all these foods. She just buys some food and lets them sit around to see what happens when it goes past their expiration dates. And so the quote from the book is, "The dates came and went, and when I opened them, the results were fairly unremarkable. My cereal and cookies looked and tasted perfectly normal, almost as if I had just bought them." And if any of my family's listening, they know what I always say is, oh, that expiration date, it's just a suggestion. No, you guys made that scary face, because as nutritionists, you probably have a different idea about that.
Well, when you're looking at a date on a box, there's usually guidelines for that. And for some, it is, in a sense, a suggestion. But for others, definitely want to, if it's a use-by date, you know, it's a suggestion. But her examples of keeping it for many years isn't really the greatest one.
And we'll find out more about why that's true, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I did find, there's a website called eatbydate.com, mm-hmm. and it does talk about, you know, there is some fallacy, mm-hmm. like it can go a little bit beyond the date, and it talks about if it's homemade versus, you know, processed and stuff, but yeah, you can go beyond the date for most of that stuff.
So Lisa agrees with me a little bit there. Okay. But then the thing she talks about, too, is that, you know, mysterious guacamole that's sitting in her refrigerator and that there weren't any red flags. And that we, as consumers, what we'll do is, and I'm sure, you know, I'm thinking everybody does this, you open something up in the fridge and you look at it and you think, well, is this still good? So we smell it. We look if there's any mold on it. And those are kind of our two main ways of knowing we have to throw this away.
Yeah, well, part of what we do in our job is to teach food safety, and there are guidelines for all Americans at the CDC website on exactly how long food should be left open in the refrigerator and consumed. So that's where I would first go instead of the sniff test, because there are millions of Americans that get sick by foodborne illnesses every year, thinking they have the flu or the cold. And it could be because they just sniffed and ate, you know.
That's not the ultimate test, then, you're saying, Winona. It's not going to catch everything. So this was another quote from the book. As a population, we ingest double the amount of added fats, half the fiber, 60% more added sugars, 3.5 times more sodium, and infinitely greater quantities of corn and soybean ingredients than we did in 1909. So I was thinking, though, but we live longer. So maybe those preservatives, additives, changes in our diet aren't all bad. And I think that's part of what we're talking about here, right?
I don't know. I would say probably it's all the jumps we've done in science, in medical science, you know what I mean, as far as being able to treat things now and better diagnostics than they had in the 1900s. But certainly we've seen a difference in diseases and conditions since then.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good point. So it's not that because we're adding those things, we become healthier and can live longer. It's we're consuming those things. And I think Lisa even wants to talk a little bit about how consuming those things makes us sicker. So we can, you know, look at some of that, too.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing is the title of the book says, you know, how processed food took over the American meal. So just thinking about what does processed mean? And so, Winona, did you have a working definition of
well,
that?
Well, I like her definition in the book as well, something that cannot be made with the same ingredients in a home kitchen. The foods that we prepare at home are not going to be overly processed. We're going to use real ingredients, and we're not going to have all the chemical additives that they can put into processed foods.
Do you add anything to that, Lisa?
No, I agree with her.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of scary, though, some of the basic things we think are unprocessed now are processed, but for the most part, we do know what's going in, yeah.
But that even gets a little muddy, because when she's talking about, if you look at the ingredients on potato chips, and it says potatoes, oil, and salt. So obviously you can make that in your kitchen, so it's not necessarily a processed food, but it's not necessarily healthy either.
That's true.
So this is where...
In moderation.
So this is why things get confusing, I think, for a lot of people when they're trying to decide what, you know... You know, how should I construct my diet?
We do have a lot of control in the kitchen, though. We don't have to add 60% more sugars, more sodium. You know, that's the benefit of cooking things at home is that you don't have to have as many of the added ingredients, and you can control that.
Well, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other quote then is, just because it's edible doesn't mean it's good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. True, huh? I thought this was interesting that I guess I assumed the cost of food had gone up, that we were spending more money on food. But what she says is that, you know, we've become accustomed to inexpensive food. In 1950, we were spending 20.6% of our disposable income on food for our homes, and now we're spending 9.8%. Were you surprised at all by that?
I wasn't personally surprised by that, just by... seeing what is in the grocery stores and seeing the type of foods that are pushed out. And it's an argument for a lot of people that they can buy inexpensive foods in higher bulk amounts. So not particularly.
Yeah,
how about you, Lisa?
Yeah. No, I wasn't either. I think the high manufacture rate and all that, you know, really kind of added. And accessibility, logistics isn't as much of an issue anymore. And, you know.
Okay. Certainly... I guess I was thinking just, you know, the cost of things going up and even more so with transportation, that would have been a bigger bite into our budget. But so I guess that was a pleasant surprise. Again, for part of our conversation here, she talks about, you know, what's real, you know, when we talk about, and she's using the example of Greek yogurt. And so we have this idea that we know what that means. So if I'm buying Greek yogurt, I'm thinking, oh, I'm getting... this particular thing. But there's no, again, standards. We don't have, like, the FDA defining what's real Greek yogurt for us. And so were you operating under that illusion, or am I the only one? Winona?
I mean, it is surprising that the FDA does not regulate a lot of things that we think are going to be a healthy choice for us on the store shelves. I guess that's where label reading is going to come into play for a lot of people doing the research themselves, because it's not necessarily being done for us.
No, and it's been 20 years since the FDA has modified, changed, you know, done the label rules, I guess, right, you know, the
kind of
guidelines.
And they're looking at that now, right?
They are, thank goodness.
And I saw an example of that, and to me it just looked like it was bigger font. But I'm sure there's other differences there. Okay. Okay, so... the other thing I like about this book is that when talking about, okay, so now we're consuming processed food. So how did it even come about that we needed processed food? And so she says, mass-scale food processing, however, requires an entirely different system of assembly, one fraught with often conflicting expectations. Manufactured food needs not only to taste good, for instance, but also to withstand the wear and tear of processing. It has to look and taste exactly the same every time. It also has to have a long shelf life to be produced cheaply and efficiently. And on top of all of that, it would be nice if it could be marketed as healthy. So there's the intention of people who process our foods. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we have our Sam's Club and our Costco's and our foods that reach up to the ceiling that need to be able to rotate down to us that we can take home and consume, and we think, you know, and we do want them to taste crunchy and not stale, and so processing does provide that. Not necessarily health, but it does provide what she's explaining as far as why it came to be. It is a business, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, they kind of set it up that way anyway. They started this whole processing. We get accustomed to it, and we want more and more, and we want more conformity and, you know, so, and less expense. So it's kind of like they started it, they got it put rolling, and now they have to maintain it.
Right.
Yeah.
And historically, it really did start because food was going to waste. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that it was interesting that it was preserving fruit. And so they saw that a lot of fruit was going to waste, and what would be a way that it could be canned or preserved so that it could continue to be consumed. So the author talks about how this work is predominantly female. And again, I guess, I don't know if I was surprised about that, but what I kind of made a note of is that because so many women work in the field of food science and looking at this, and again, I guess I'm not surprised because we kind of expect women and food are connected. Yeah, you know, that women, yeah, you're laughing. But yeah, I mean, traditionally, yeah. Women, you know, prepare the food. So, but, you know, so what, you know, what kind of values do you think women have, or what motivates them to go into this work of food science and working to preserve our foods and make them accessible to the masses?
Well, there's a couple of things I saw. First of all was the pervasive attitude she had said, and I'm quoting her, mm-hmm. about making bad things a little healthier. You know, I think, honestly, male or female, the original intent is just interest. I mean, they seem really scientifically motivated more than anything like that. And I think then they have some altruistic ideas, you know, we're going to make things healthier, I'm going to help out. But I don't know. I'd like to think it's for the greater good. But you could see how, as you read the book, how different the attitudes are. It's not what they eat, but they'll produce it.
Right. And we'll talk about a couple of those examples, too. Yeah. So historically, this idea that we transitioned from a culture that we all grew our own foods to now we're working and we're not able to necessarily grow our own foods or make our own foods, and so we're relying on this food marketing system to provide our foods.
Yeah.
And you're both nodding your head. Yep, like that's right. That's you know, where we ended up.
It is where we ended up. Whether it's the best place where we ended up, it is, you know, and in the working families and more women going to work, and the fact that they still had the responsibility of preparing the meal at the end of the day was probably another one of the motivations for their work. You know, how can we create a quick, easy meal and still have it taste good, you know?
Yeah. Right. So a little piece of history again was this man in the late 1800s, Harvey Wiley. I don't know if either of you had ever heard of him before.
I hadn't.
Yeah. So, but again, interesting that right from kind of the get-go that we're starting to process foods, we have a champion right at the beginning who says, wait a minute, what's going into these processed foods? And so he was testing the foods on people. And I love the name of those subjects, the poison squad, mm-hmm. because he would actually inject them with poisonous materials, right, to see how much they could withstand and not get sick, or what the effects would be. And so he's shining all this light on these additives to food, and he's not getting a very favorable kind of response, would you say? It's not like people are going, oh, you're right, it's bad, let's get it out of there.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely, I think, company-driven, of course. You know, we see still today they're going to lobby against it because it's going to cause, takeaway. But, I mean, one of the things, like, that startled me was, like, the bread being bulked up by sawdust. I mean, there was some pretty scary things they were doing back then with no regulation at all.
Right. And it wasn't until 1906 when Roosevelt signed some of the first laws that governed our food. So until that time, it was anything goes.
Yeah, he was an interesting fellow.
He was.
Yeah.
And later went to work for Good Housekeeping. And so it was Wiley who started that seal of approval, the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. So here we are 100 years later, and we're still dealing with some of the additives he preached against because nothing has changed. I want to remind our listening audience that this is the Radio Book Club on 89.5 Radio Free Palmer. And if you'd like to join the discussion, please call us at 745-8900. Okay, so the most fun chapter, I thought, title was Chapter 3, The Quest for Eternal Cheese. So, Winona, any thoughts about Kraft and their invention of
eternal cheese? Yeah, this was a very eye-opening chapter for me. You know it's processed cheese, but the way that it came about, and I remember when I growing up eating those sea rats, we called them because my dad was in the Navy, the cheese, the canned cheese that was in the sea rations, and it always was the same. And as I was reading this, it's like, wow, that was
okay,
it.
So I never had the canned cheese. Is that like Cheese Whiz in texture?
It was kind of like Cheese Whiz, kind of like, yeah, it was kind of runny. You could dip it. But not runny, I shouldn't say runny. It was still solid, but it was soft. It was bright orange and salty and
cheese color.
Yeah, but I do remember the canned cheese.
And again, the start of this wasn't for bad reasons. It was that as they were moving cheese around in the city, it would mold or, decompose quickly. And so the idea was, how can we preserve the cheese so that it would last longer? So Kraft did what he did to this food that they would try to call cheese. So just a kind of interesting statistic, 1930 processed cheese was 40% of all cheese consumed in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah. And in 1932, a study, two-thirds of people preferred the taste of processed food.
Well, I do have to say, when I was reading the book, I did a little bit of research and kind of the ads that were going around. And you start to see the beginning of that fear element in advertising, because when they were advertising the cheese, it was, it was new, safe, and clean. No old unsanitary methods. And so it was interesting, that fear factor of people, I've got to eat this cheese because it's better, it's healthier, we'll live. Even though they're probably, I'm sure it changed some things, but I'm sure it wasn't that drastic. I mean, cheese is pretty obvious,
But what does it imply about how our cheese is made?
The other cheeses,
yeah, they're rolling it on the floor or something, and the dog, with dirty hands and coughing on it.
Which is probably why the Wisconsin cheesemakers were so incredibly angry when the fake cheese came out,
And they didn't have a good as lobby, apparently. So it's starting, so when the rules change, they really can't call it like a cheese food anymore. Now it's called a cheese product. So even though the word cheese is in there, there's very little about it that is actual cheese.
I don't think they should be able to call it cheese.
It's pretty scary. And there's even, there's some other interesting cheeses that are on the store shelf now in the grated cheese section that are, they say right on them, not cheese, cheese product. And yeah, it's kind of scary. Yep. I think.
So since you brought up the shredded cheese, what is on that stuff?
What is on it?
Well, because it doesn't clump. If you grate cheese at home.
It's cellulose, isn't it? Cellulose gum, which is like a wood product.
So I quit buying shredded cheese because I figured just shred it at home because there's some additive to it, obviously, to keep it all nice little shredded shapes of cheese.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know all the additives that are in it, but it's obviously a processed
food, because they're doing something to it. They're adding something to it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So just the other thing with natural cheese has bacteria in it. It's how it processes and it gives it flavor. And with Kraft cheese or the prepared cheese product, it doesn't have bacteria. So that's why I raised that question, is it even cheese and why did they get to call it that?
Just a little note on that, in our, you know, a big population today has a lot of stomach problems because they don't have a lot of good bacteria because so much of the good bacteria is taken out in this processing. So we have a lot of people walking around with food intolerances and candida buildup inside of the body. And this is just one example of it in that in cheese, natural cheese, there's natural bacteria. Same with yogurt. You know, when you're eating natural yogurt, it's natural bacteria. It's a healthier food. So when we are eating something that's overprocessed, it's just not good stomach food or gut food.
No, exactly. And then couple that with the overuse of antibiotics, you just have this constant, you know, good point.
And so then people will turn to some other product to make up for that. So the probiotic stuff, or now I need to introduce bacteria back into my diet because I'm trying to make this balance.
Which in today's diet, I think it's a must. I think that adding probiotics is necessary because our food is so processed.
Wow. And more like in an edible form or pills?
A pill, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, that chapter ended with Wiley saying, food must not be dead, it must have a soul. And I thought, you know, Wiley wasn't just a scientist, he was a poet. Oh, I do want to say one other thing about the cheese thing, because the author, this is one of the foods that she tucks away and she keeps just to see what happens to it, and ends up taking a slice, a four-year-old slice of cheese. Now, okay, I'm not the best cleaner, and sometimes I have to admit things will fall to the bottom in my refrigerator, and I'm sure I found some cheese that was rather old, processed cheese slices. And they curl up and they get dry, and again, there's no mold, there's no smell. But this obviously is not appetizing.
No, and interesting how they've gone against that basic survival instinct of smell and taste with these processes. So you don't know. You mean you really don't as just a human if this stuff is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you guess, how long has that been in there? Yeah. I think we ask that question more often. How long has that
right.
been in there?
And growing up, I used to say to my mom, taste this. Is it bad?
Right. Or the fact that she licked it to see you know, what was on top of it that was starting to
pill
up there. Yeah. So she wanted to know if it was salt, you know. So after 4 years, she licked it to see.
That was brave of her.
Oh, very
yeah,
brave.
Who knows what, you know, chemical processes had happened to it. So the next chapter talks about cereal. And so this depressed me. Now I'm not even eating my cereal that's in my house.
Yes.
But one thing I guess that didn't surprise me was the number of cereal choices we have. So most grocery stores, there's an entire aisle of cereal choices. Mm-hmm. Part of me was thinking it's because I think as a culture we constantly crave variety. And I think this is true when I look at the chip aisle too. So there's like always a new flavor or a new something that's coming out. And just to give it a number, mm-hmm. she says that Walmart carries 215 kinds of cereal.
When we do a lesson with the kids sometimes on media, and we've talked about how cereal is one of the most marketed foods for children. And so most of it is at the head height of a 10-year-old, and it's all colorful, and it's got characters all over it. And so every time a new character can come out on TV, we can introduce a new type of cereal too. And this is the one food that is usually put in bulk, lower prices for families, and then usually has some type of a, you know, it's good for you, claim on the front of it. So it's a big, I don't know what's the word I want to use. It's one of those foods that's kind of a tricky food out there that mm-hmm. is claimed as healthy, but it really is not the best choice.
No, it isn't. In fact, I looked through all our cereals for that whole grain seal of approval, and only one I could find on all brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though they're now all saying they're made with whole grains, and, you know, but if you look at the ingredients, sugar is always the first thing listed in most of these, or, you know, whole wheat flour, supposedly, and
or corn, right?
Or corn, corn mostly, yeah.
And again, historically, John Harvey Kellogg wanted to mm-hmm. have a food that was healthy. He was a little bit of an odd character, and he wanted to provide good, nutritious food, and so his intentions were good. And I thought it was funny. It was like, that his brother added the sugar. And so John Harvey was just appalled, and he said, get the sugar out of there. But obviously people liked it with the sugar on there. And who doesn't? Who doesn't like sugar? But, okay, so you were saying that, you know, it is a little mind-bending because it'll have all these claims on there, you know, that cereal, it sounds like it's a good thing. Cereal is a word that means grains, and so we think of it as something natural or good for us. Mm-hmm. But in the processing of cereal, it's so destructive in how they pound and bang and remold those grains that anything of nutritional value seems to be pounded and processed right out of it. So instead, then they have to come along behind and then add the nutrients. And so I don't know, do you either one of you want to say anything about what happens? What's the difference between, you know, a nutrient being there in a food and now they're coming back and they have to add it?
Oh, gosh, a lot with that. You know, as we read in the book, too, you know, I mean, it's not a natural nutrient. This is man-made. So, you know, we don't know how readily absorbed it is by the body or utilized or in conjunction with other things, could that be good? I felt like you said, very bad for a cereal. Horrible way to start.
Yeah.
And our whole grains have our bran and the germ that are located in the plant, and those are removed when they are put through this processing. So when they're removed, so is the B vitamins, and so is the folate, which creates new cells. So we're virtually losing most all of the nutrients before the actual, let's go through the machinery. Then once it goes through the extruders, then they've got to spray on some type of vitamin. So that's what the book tells us, is that they put on 30% more than what it even says on the label because it's lost just from shelf time when it sits on the shelf. So,
and that's when I had my expiration date kind of epiphany, because I thought, okay, that's part of it too, is that it's sitting there and these nutrients or vitamins are degrading and they're losing their potency as, you know, as you say, on the shelf. So, and just the words, I mean, you used the term the extrusion machine, but they also talk about the process called plasticization. And I thought, boy, that's a lovely thought, right, that these foods we're putting in our mouth have gone through a process that somehow involves plastic. That just doesn't sound good. And I think this is something you guys were getting at, was that she talks about our digestive tracts were made to process crunchy, fibrous foods. And that by having grains now that are broken down, a little bit of what you were getting at, Winona, that somehow will alter our metabolism. And then can you say a little bit of something about, because it's changing our metabolism, it changes when we think we're hungry or when we realize we're full.
Right.
How's that connected?
Well, when a food is really partially broken down for you, it will automatically convert to glucose in the body. And it does, it will change your satiation on how you feel that you're full. It also increases your blood sugar levels almost immediately. So it does play with, most people will know when they eat a big bowl of sugary cereal, 20 minutes later they're hungry.
They're hungry again,
as opposed to eating a big bowl of oatmeal, where that can last for 4 hours in the tummy because it's got all three parts of the whole plant.
And they mention that cereals are really just empty calories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that they become fortified, but we don't even know how good that is. So we're going to go to the half hour and be back.
You are listening to KVRF FM, Radio Free Palmer. Our program schedule and playlists are available online at radiofreepalmer.org. Big Cabbage Radio.
I want to talk about the addition of vitamins into our foods. And the chapter on this started out, again, with a kind of a scary thing. So she starts out talking about Australian sheep, and you're wondering, where is this going? So the wool from Australian sheep gets sent to China, where the lanolin then from the sheep is extracted. And from that, we'll say greasy product, I don't know, vitamin D is obtained. Yeah, Winona, you're making scary face, too.
This chapter scared me. Mm-hmm. I just want to go lay in the sun. Forget it.
Today's a good day to do that.
Yeah, that was really bizarre to me that was how that was brought to us in our vitamin form.
Oh, same here. And then all the process. And was it a petroleum product that they used to extract it? It was scary, yeah.
Yeah.
So many people may think that, we go to the store, we buy our vitamin supplements, and that seems like a good thing. And I had read something about where much of our vitamin supplements are coming from China. And that's scary, because then you read about how in China they don't have the same, and then you wonder, well, the same, we don't even have very good regulations, but they even have less regulations about food production and manufacturing than we do. So what are they doing, and who's watching them, and what's going into these things that are vitamin supplements? So all of that's a little bit frightening, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
It is. And then we don't even know, and I think you had mentioned this, the actual absorption of the vitamins that we do take, so much of it is just lost just through waste in the body. So food is going to be, the best way that we can get the vitamins that we need, real mm-hmm. whole foods.
And we don't know if we're getting too much or not enough.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that was brought up in the book, too, about just taking too much or like, some people get overconfident taking vitamins and they'll skip eating and take a vitamin, and then most of the diets that we see are lacking the fat soluble D, E, and K, which I don't know. I don't firmly believe in supplements that much. I think mm-hmm. really healthy eating is the way to go. Mm-hmm. But, of course, living in Alaska, vitamin D is important.
Well, so. And it's one of those additives to
yes.
food, so it's included in especially like milk.
Mm-hmm.
The author says, in fact, vitamins and minerals are so thoroughly embraced that they're the only synthetic ingredients with carte blanche approval for inclusion in certified organic products, even when those vitamins and minerals are produced with genetically modified bacteria or have been synthesized from noxious petrochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
So genetically modified technology and toxic chemicals are otherwise banned from organics. Call something a vitamin, and it seems like it's just fine to put in our food.
Right.
Is kind of the lesson I take away from that.
Without yeah. thought. And that's part of the trust issue that we have as Americans, is that we think what's in our food is going to be okay. And we don't really know. That's made this book a really interesting read. It was pretty eye-opening about, some of the stuff that we just generally don't know about.
Nope. Yeah.
And I have to say, by the time I got to the chapter on fats, which we're coming up to, I started to think, it is just easier to eat what they give us. It's almost mind-boggling and overwhelming when you start to read this stuff. And if I tell myself, because she talks about this in the last chapter, about closer to the ground, if we just try to remember to eat things that are closer to the ground so that mm-hmm. kind of fresh, they haven't been through a lot of different handlings, that's the best way to think about our foods.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we even have a disorder now, orthorexia, which is a fear of eating bad foods. And people would opt not to eat if fear of eating something that's processed or genetically modified. And it's scary. I mean, so they're, malnutrition, sets in because they're not eating because it's so bad. So.
Okay. Well, and just to make one more connection with the vitamins, that there is more to the picture. We thought that the vitamins were kind of like the, when you think about like the atom, kind of like that basic level of what we're talking about. But now they're looking at the phytochemicals, and you two probably know more about that, that there's an interaction there and that's also an important element in what we're taking in and how we're using the vitamins that are there. Winona, did you want to say something?
Well, I think the biggest thing with that is that when we look at phytochemicals and enzymes and minerals, the best way to get the most effective use of those is through whole plant foods. Mm-hmm. And when they start to add, chemically enhanced phytochemicals, it's never going to be as the rich source of the vegetable is going to be. So if like the terms antioxidants are put on the food, it's a pretty loose term,
mm-hmm.
Put on juices and, candies and all kinds of things. But it's not the true phytochemicals that are found in the colors of the fruits and vegetables that we consume.
Interesting.
Oh, fish. And I almost think it's like, sounds silly, but the phytochemicals are like the spiritualness of the food we eat, because not enough is known on how they work in the with the body. And all the, I mean, they do a lot of things, but sometimes minute, sometimes bigger. And I don't think they could ever be really reproduced. I think that's something that we're always just going to have to get in the whole food end.
Yeah.
The next chapter goes into just, I think, just additives in general. And when Pew Charitable Trust came up with a list of 5,000 additives, so, you know, why additives in our food? And I guess I'll just read again what the author says about that. But besides improving texture and making food last longer than it has any right to, food additives help make food taste good, either by adding desirable flavors or masking those that might otherwise send us reeling in disgust. They make everything stick together and give what food scientists call good mouthfeel. They also help food look attractive. So again, we're being tricked in some ways that, you know, this idea that they're adding things to disguise things that we don't want to taste. And the science of mapping the tongue, so knowing where those taste receptors are, and then being able to put things in into our foods so we don't taste the disgusting parts.
Well, half the disgusting parts are done through their manufacturing. That's the sad thing, you know. And I like a good tangy, dank cheese. You know, I don't mind that. Don't shield me from that. Don't make that decision for me. Yeah.
Don't put the cheese in the plastic wrap then.
Yeah, I don't.
It is, like I said earlier, it's a business. So they're putting out a lot more food for a lot less money. And so now they've got to, through all the processing, it might come out, I think it's explained in here as, you know, a gray, a kind of an ugly color, and they've got to make it look palatable for us. We eat with our eyes first, so it's got to look good. And then of course, they've got to put the coloring in there, which is in nearly every processed food that we eat, you know. So I'll go back to the rainbow on the plate. So the more fruits and vegetables we have on the plate, the more color and the more real it is.
Mm-hmm. Their cure for everything is, oh, you know, we did something to it now that has bad smell or bad color, so we need to add something else to fix that kind
That's
of thinking.
That's so scary.
Yep. And we really don't know. We don't know what the overconsumption of these additives is doing to us. We don't know what these blends of things are doing to us. So, and what it's doing to children. And I think anecdotally, people will talk about ADHD and how they control that with diet. And I'm sure the two of you have more information on that and what you see as far as maybe impacts of these things that you hear, how it affects people or children.
Yeah, I think when people go to a more whole foods diet, we see less heart disease, we see less diabetes, you see less behavioral issues. I believe that's even in this book. Was it addressing about a young boy?
Oh, yes. He had ADHD. Oh, no, actually, he was tested for a bunch of things, and
behavioral issues and changing the diet, going to Whole Foods and getting off the processed foods. Suddenly, he became a normal young man, and there's science to back that up as well. So going Whole Foods and going more real foods definitely helps to fight off the major diseases that we see that are pretty prevalent.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And maybe it's not necessary that there's a label to it that, that it can cause ADHD. I think that when people experiment with their diets, as the family she talks about in the book, they just wanted to try it for a week, but several members of the family noticed these incredible differences and wanted to continue on their new diet. And so even though there wasn't a label that, oh, this fixed his whatever it was, and she said that he seemed more filled in. He wasn't so, foggy around the edges. So she didn't have a, real medical or scientific way of describing it, but knew that there was a difference there, and the boy knew there was a difference.
Right. And I think we see that even, gluten-free. Okay, a lot of people are doing that without having celiac disease. But because they're choosing to go gluten-free, they're being more choosy about their foods. Mm-hmm. So the outcropping of that is, less indigestion or whatever, but I think it's really just healthful eating. They're just all of a sudden mindfully eating, put it that way, than just putting whatever was given to them in their mouth. So,
I found fault with one interview that she did in here, and it was with the one woman who was a food scientist, and I think it was because when she asked this woman questions, I think it was in such a way that she wanted the woman to feel guilty. And I don't know if you, mm-hmm. okay, because part of what the woman was talking about, and you get this from a few of the interviews she does, that these are food scientists, so they're working with these processing foods, adding additives, adding enzymes, nutrients, all those sort of things. But this is not the food these people eat. These people go home and eat whole foods, eat closer to the ground. And I thought that she was really making an issue then about class, that is it only the middle and upper class people who can afford to have that attitude that, okay, you know, this is food for the masses, you know, you eat all these additives and chemicals and things. Because when she interviewed that one woman, and I mean, she almost made it sound like she should feel guilty about what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you got that sense at all. It was with Wright was the scientist
yes,
she was talking to.
Yes, they went to that fancy restaurant in
New York.
They
went to a fancy restaurant, yes. So, I don't know, did you not get that?
I got it, if you had been
No, go ahead.
Well, I got it too, but I think that, Warner said, it's a symptom of intellectual compartmentalization, so of the science of the contemporary workplace. So she was able to say, yes, that's what I do. I know. But I don't, you know, it's more of a scientific view. So she kind of removes herself as a person from what she's doing. And she's now the scientist. But then she goes home and does something different. I mean, that could have been part of it. She seemed really good-natured.
Yeah.
I think the field of the food science, a lot of them just love what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're creating new things. It's kind of an art project, you know, they're seeing what they can create with these chemicals and how it can look like food. And I mean, we saw that with the making of the hot dog. So is she trying to elevate herself? I don't think so. I think she was just looking at her job as, like you said, that's my job, that's what I do, but this is my life and this is my lifestyle. That's kind of how I saw it.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about fats. I have to say that this was the most confusing thing for me, and so it was kind of interesting at the end of that chapter when she talked about how it's confusing for everybody. Because we're told trans fats are bad, and then there's polyunsaturated fats, and so I just put, man, I'm confused. And that's when I thought it's just easier to eat what they give us because I don't get it. So can you provide any enlightenment on fats, either one of you?
Sure. Trans fats are chemically man-made fats that are done by manually changing the way hydrogen is in the fat. It is known to cause heart disease. It is something we should avoid on a food label. Too much saturated fat we know causes heart disease. Heart disease is still the number one killer, and it's only increased every single year. So we don't have a good reason to ever eat it because it obviously causes heart disease. Polyunsaturated and monounsaturated, those are our good fats. But I think the key to remember is that a fat is a fat, and that every teaspoon is 9 calories, and you should never overdo it. And, you know, recommendation is 2 tablespoons a day of added fat to your uh-huh. diet. So,
how many grams is that? Do you know?
Oh.
No, I have to use my calculator.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's for the metric system.
But, yeah.
No, we don't.
But I know that when I was having some medical issues and I had to look at how much fat I was consuming, it was very difficult. I would try, if I was going to eat anything that was labeled, I would try to have something that only had 4 grams in it.
No, I guess I do know that now that you say that. It's 5 grams is 1 teaspoon.
1 teaspoon.
When we want to measure it out that way.
Okay. So that's not very much. And the point the author makes here is that because of our consumption of soybean oil, that was the single greatest, most rapid dietary change in our history. And again, here's a plant that's relatively new in our culture anyway and to use as food. And the process they go through to get the oil out.
Oh,
what
my gosh.
What do you think, Lisa?
That was scary. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, everything was flammable, and I mean, just that they had to, even their skin exposure, there would be problems, and oh my gosh, and she was nervous being in the factory. It's uh-huh. hexane, I believe, is the chemical they
right.
use. Yep.
Right,
so that was startling, and we eat that.
Yes.
Right, and canola oil, which is our soybean oil, is put out there as one of our healthy oils. So when you see the processing of it here, it's like, maybe not so much, you know.
Mm-hmm. And she makes the point, it interferes with both enzyme and hormone production and protein synthesis because apparently there's the toxic aldehydes that are a part of the oils.
Wow.
And once you start to mess with the hormones, that's when we also know that that's when cancers start to form in the body.
Yep.
For women, breast cancer. For men, it's prostate cancer.
And then did you notice what Monsanto and DuPont's answer was to some of the problems with oils?
Oh, let's see. I think I...
They would just go in and mess with the DNA of it some more.
Oh, that's true. Down the,
yes, because most soybeans used in this country are genetically modified. Mm-hmm. And
so they're just going to keep messing with it.
So they're just going to keep messing with it. So then my thought was, well, when is it no longer a soybean? You know, when have they changed the DNA so much? But now it's not a soybean. It's a Monsanto bean or something.
And that's what they should be forced to rename it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and in a sense, I mean, they already own all the crops. So it really is named that.
Yep.
If you read on the farms, it's all... owned by them and controlled by them.
So just a reminder to everyone listening out there, this is the Radio Book Club. We're talking about Pandora's Lunchbox and about processed food and the American diet. If you'd like to call us, we still have about 15 minutes left of the show, so give us a call. Let us know what you're thinking, 745-8900. So after the soybean oil, one of the other things that they do with the soybeans is they extract the protein. And this is a very versatile food. And again, I'm a vegetarian. And so I know I eat, you know, quite a bit probably of soy protein. But I guess I thought it was funny that they were putting it in meats. Now, so I don't have a problem with that. And the reason they put it in meat is that it's supposed to help it stay moist and juicy longer. So are both of you meat eaters?
A little bit, yeah. I'm not a big meat eater.
Okay, so how did you feel about that? How did you feel about, or did you already know
that?
I'm
very grateful my husband gets game. I love my wild game.
Okay, so you're not injecting it with any soy protein on the side. Okay.
And that also, you know, it opens up so many other things, like, you know, that so the meats can sit around longer. So you've got even more vitamin loss in the restaurants and stuff because they're under these hot lights. And it's pretty sad. It's just this chemical thing we call meat.
I think if it was tested, it probably wouldn't be a whole lot of meat there.
Well, for a while they had a rule about how much of it could be added to children's lunches. And then apparently now that's even changed, that there was this 30% limit, but now they've taken that out. So we don't even know how much of it they're adding to.
No, we don't. Nope. We don't.
Sad.
But on the, you know, on the more positive side, she does say soy protein is not harmful. We're just not sure if it's beneficial. So maybe it's the sawdust in the bread.
I have to say, my daughter was labeled lactose intolerant really severely as a baby. I couldn't breastfeed. So she was put on soy-based. And she's suffering from polycystic ovarian syndrome. And now really encouraged not to have any soy because of, I mean, it's still testing, but you just tend to wonder. You know, we safely thought, could she have the perfect storm to respond negatively to that? Mm-hmm. But is it, you know?
Right.
Well, and she even mentions that in its raw form, soybean meal doesn't taste very good, and it contains a compound that blocks the absorption of essential minerals.
Wow.
So once we start to block essential minerals in the body, we're starting to look at deficiencies and a myriad of diseases or side effects that could happen to the body.
Mm-hmm.
This is the chapter that she tells probably the two most disgusting anecdotes in when she does her little experiment with the chicken nuggets and, you know, ends up with liquid chicken.
Yeah.
So to just let them deteriorate, and she's got just a bag of liquids, and then she even takes them back to the manufacturer to ask, you know, what is in this? And they're surprised even that happened. But I guess probably one of the grossest things I read was it was – about the process of making chicken nuggets. So if, spoiler alert, if you are a chicken nugget fan, you don't want to listen to this. A product made by pushing a leftover, nearly meatless animal carcass through a giant tea bag-like screen at pressure so high that the whole thing, the skin, bones, connective tissue, and all, turns into a meat smoothie.
That was so gross. I shared that with my family.
There's a great YouTube video on that one, too. You can get a visual on it.
I got one just from reading it. That was enough for me. So I was glad I was done with those. But yes, we will all go through McDonald's and buy our children some lovely chicken nuggets. Huh? I like the Alfred E. Newman quote. We are living in a world today where lemonade is made from artificial flavors and furniture polish is made from real lemons. Where are our priorities? Another thing that surprised me, flavor of dirt in baked goods.
That it would be desired?
Yes.
And that's a big thing in New York. They're starting to really incorporate dirt into the foods. Yeah. And I was trying to find
it's
the article.
It's getting a little too earthy for me.
So do you think that's, again, trying to trick us into, you know, that earthy, that we're back closer to the ground? Look, even our brownies taste like dirt. I don't even think.
It's probably a bit of a mind gimmick. You know, I would think so.
You'd think they'd pick a different word than dirt because, I mean, does that sound appetizing to you? Have some dirt. Eat this. It tastes like dirt.
No, but I think it's that. I think there's kind of a movement out there that we are trying to eat more healthy or trying to eat more raw foods. And that kind of fits into that personification of what that lifestyle might be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And then trend, you know, something different, you know.
Well, and the trend is that they're trying to make healthy processed foods, which maybe is an oxymoron, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Healthy processed foods. One of the stories, she talks about a fiber additive, and it's in biscotti. And I thought that she hit this one right on the head, too, where if, because I can see myself doing this. Let's say you eat something, even though it's a processed food, but it's a healthy processed food, and it's something sweet. And so you don't think that that's taken the place of something sweet. And so later on, you consume another sweet thing. So you kind of mess with your own mind thinking, well, I ate healthy earlier, so now I can eat something unhealthy. And you're not really accomplishing anything.
Right. I think that was quoted somewhere else in the book where she was referring to how we went lower fat in our foods, and it just made for more increased consumption of other foods, and people were actually gaining more weight going to lower fat foods.
Yep, and she called that, was it the snack well?
Yeah.
Theory, yeah, when those cookies came out.
The 100 calories.
Yeah, they were just eating them and eating them. Yeah.
So they eat three bags of them instead of one. Yeah.
So we do have that mindset of, I'll eat this, you know, tend healthy food, but, you know, then I'm free to do whatever I want later, which is a terrible trap that a lot of us get into.
She talked a little bit about the president's wife, Michelle Obama's goal to end childhood obesity and how she really called on the food industry to create more healthy options. And I think the author is saying, too, that it's not likely we're all going to say, you know, as a result of reading this book or hearing this show or doing any number of anything, say, I'm changing my diet. Most people are just not going to do that. They're still going to go get their, you know, TV dinners and their, you know, pizza pockets or whatever. And so given that we're not going to change necessarily what we do, can the food industry provide us healthier processed foods? What do you guys think?
I liked your oxymoron comment before. I mean, and we've mentioned it, you know, can you ever reproduce broccoli? No, probably not. Can you ever, you know, change the way a whole plant, break it down and make it that whole plant, you know, shaped like a dinosaur? No, you can't, you know. So are they going to provide healthier foods? Who knows what's going to happen with science, but I still think that, you know, eating it from its original form is the best bet.
I agree with you. And one of the things she brought up was ads for the raw chicken. Remember Frank Perdue used to do actual ads for raw chicken. Mm-hmm. You don't see any ads for raw food like that. Mm-hmm. It's all, now it's pre-cooked varieties of food. It's not, you know, my chickens are the freshest. Uh-huh. So it's interesting how it's
the picture is your advertisement. You get a picture of a farm on the chicken package, but doesn't mean that that's real chicken from a farm.
Exactly.
It's a little misleading. Well, she does give one example, and I guess I thought this was interesting, too, that the Mars company, because they're not a publicly traded company and they're owned, the family still controls all the stock, they had a little more leeway on doing some experimentation on a healthy food. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that it's very expensive doing the research and coming up with the product, and it is difficult to make something that's healthy, even though it's processed. And so they did come up with like a nutrition bar, I guess you would call it.
Bars.
Yeah, something along mm-hmm. that line. And it seemed like the taste tests went well. So what do you think is the problem with that kind of a product?
I still think when you're buying things like Clif Bars, Luna Bars, protein bars, you still need to pay attention to the sugar consumption.
Definitely.
They're generally always high in sugar, and they all have multiple sugar additives, even though it might be real or whole type sugar foods. Just watching how many grams you're taking in is very important. Obesity, diabetes, those are still big issues in America today.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting was the placement. She talks about how they didn't know where to put it in the grocery store. And we've really become that is our focus. Like you had brought up about the store, the cereal. If you do, notice on the top, it's going to be all the adult cereal.
Mm-hmm.
Yogurt, same thing, the high-sugar yogurt, or, the really flavorful yogurt and kid yogurts are right there. You want to look at the bottom or look at the top.
Mm-hmm.
So they no one knew that this was out there because they didn't know where to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're in the health food section.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to find
it. That would
help. Wood floors.
Yeah. With the wood floors and the better lighting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the author says the more fat and sugar you take out, the more they're replaced by other cheap, empty ingredients,
mm-hmm.
whether zero-calorie sweeteners, starches, gums, or taste modification molecules. And just because something is low in calories, this doesn't mean it's healthy. Just as taking out artificial ingredients, while commendable, doesn't make a food good for us, only less bad.
Yep.
So a lot of confusion then, I think, for people trying to, pick something that is healthy to eat. Lisa, you mentioned the commercials earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So the author does talk a little bit about that and how it really helped pave the way for processed foods.
Yes, definitely. Oh, yeah, the commercials. And, look at how easy your life will be, and the mommy running around and we can solve you, we can help you. Winona had mentioned about the children, the ad, how children really lead a lot of the shopping now,
mm-hmm.
with ketchups and cereals,
mm-hmm.
and... Yeah, so it's kind of sad that we're so dictated by TV. So,
but average American spends, I think, 7 hours in front of the television. So,
well, there's our cooking time, because I was just going to point out the interesting statistic that we used to spend 5 to 6 hours a day preparing meals in 1927, and now we're down to about 30 minutes. So if we cooked in front of the TV, maybe that would help.
That's right.
Okay. So we've got about a minute left. So let's just talk about some of the last ideas here, maybe. I think there is a food movement out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a lot of books. When I picked this book, I was also looking at some other books. So there's a lot of information. Maybe, like I said earlier, maybe too much. People get overwhelmed by how can I figure this out. I think there's activism. I think there's, there's a whole movement about labeling foods that are GMOs, genetically modified. So, do you think that this is going to make an impact? How can we, change the way more people eat?
Well, I'll just do a plug for our extension office.
I was going to say, we've got
one thing that we do through the extension office is to offer ways to teach people how to cook, how to go to the grocery store and pick their groceries, and then plan meals with those healthy food choices. We talk about food safety and the nutrition that can be found in the foods once they are cooked. So through the extension, they can come to us and we can do one-on-one. We do group classes on cooking and nutrition lessons.
And that's important because mm-hmm. we assume that, people get that in their homes. But it's not necessarily true.
Mm-mm.
That maybe there's a generation where, there wasn't a mom or dad in the kitchen cooking. And so mm-hmm. we need to take a class and learn that.
Yep.
So I want to thank Winona and Lisa. I'm sure we didn't get through everything, so we could have gone on and on, but it was fun talking to both of you, so thank you so much for joining me. Next month, the Radio Book Club is going to be discussing poetry. It's National Poetry Month, and just as a part of that, I wanted to let you know that at Fireside on the second Saturday, you can go in and collect words from around town and create your own poem, sentence, or paragraph, so that's always kind of a fun event. And my guests next month will be Dr. Debbie Fox, is an English professor at Matsu College, and also David Cheesham, owner of Fireside Books, and as I call him, a poetry fan extraordinaire. Dr. Fox will be selecting poems for us to talk about, and so watch for those links on the Radio Free Palmer's website. We ask our readers to share their favorite poems also. Until then, I'm Judy Getty, and this is Radio Free Palmer. Thanks.